arrive at Sinner's house an hour before midday, if I wished to be present at his funeral. Fulvia was behind Caesar's funeral, and she's behind this one as well, I said.
What of it, Papa? The two events aren't remotely similar. Tens of thousands of people wanted to attend Caesar's funeral. Veterans rushed to Rome from all over Italy. But for Cinna, well, famous as he may have been among poetry lovers, how many people would risk coming to the city now, with all the rioting, and to attend a funeral with no body and no proper funeral pyre?
Is it the corpse people come for, then, and the flames?
That means more than speeches to most people. Yes, to see the body and then watch it turn to ashes.
Is that what a funeral is really about? To witness flesh become ash?
Diana shrugged. You can remember the dear departed at any time and in any place, and talk about him whenever and with whomever you wish. But only at a funeral can you see the purification of the mortal remains.
Perhaps men and women have different ideas about funerals, I said quietly.
Well, I think it's quite reasonable, Fulvia, to have the funeral immediately, if only to put it in the past, for the sake of poor Sappho. If the girl is as fragile as you say, why subject her to day after day of mourning and visits from people she doesn't even know? Quickly done is best done. Didn't some poet say that?
Ennius, I think.
There, then. Fulvia is only taking her cue from a famous poet. And wouldn't Cinna approve?
The ceremony was held in the room where the bier without a body had been set up. The bier was situated in such a way that a beam of midday sun shone through the skylight onto the blood-soaked tunic. The folds of cloth and clotted blood seemed almost to sparkle, as if the dark garment were strewn with tiny rubies. A small stone altar had been placed in the room as well, on which the tunic could be burned, its smoke escaping through the opening above. The crowd was sparse, considering Cinna's fame. Perhaps Diana was right, that in the aftermath of Caesar's funeral, few people would come to Cinna's funeral, no matter how much notice was given or time allowed for travel. Antony was there, looking grim in his consul's toga, his frown tightened to a wince from time to time. Perhaps he was hungover. It struck me that he was, to some degree, at least indirectly responsible for Cinna's death. His eulogy had provoked the mob's fury, with deadly results. Fulvia was there, too. Her black gown was an elegant garment with jewelled belts below her breasts and around her midsection. The jewels were quite large and all in shades of red and purple, rubies, amethysts, carnelians. Had she worn the same gown to Caesar's funeral? I tried to remember. Surely she had been among the women who surrounded Calpurnia at the Regia, but I didn't recall seeing her. If she had been there and had been wearing that dress, I would have noticed and remembered. Or perhaps not, given all the distractions and confusion. Mito stood beside me. This was the first time I had seen him since the day before Caesar's funeral. With Caesar gone, Mito seemed to have placed himself completely at Antony's disposal. He was Antony's man now. Lepidus was there. With Caesar dead, could it be that he and Mito and I were the only mortals alive who had heard the whole of Cinna's Orpheus and Pentheus? But no, that wasn't correct. I'd forgotten the presence of Decimus at that Last Supper, as if my mind wished to erase him from the scene, to expunge him from memory. How completely normal Decimus had seemed that night. Only hours later, he would literally stab Caesar in the back.
My wife and daughter had come. Looking around the room, I saw many more women than men. I didn't recognize most of them. They abstained from hysterical weeping. Not family, then. Wives of magistrates, poetry lovers. From their ages they looked more likely to be friends of Fulvia than of Sappho. Perhaps they were there simply to fill the room. The fragrance was more pleasant than at most funerals. There was no decaying flesh to contribute its own odour to the room. I smelled only early spring flowers and hints of cinnamon and frankincense. After the usual prayers and invocations, Antony stepped forward and cleared his throat. As Sappho's new protector and the guardian in charge of her inheritance, he explained, it fell to him to say a few words of greeting and also to deliver the eulogy. But rather than recite one date after another and list the offices he held, such facts would merely make him sound like any other Roman of his time and class. I think it better to speak those words for which he will be eternally famous, remembered for all time to come. He cleared his throat again. A nearby slave pressed a scroll into his hand, and Antony commenced to read aloud the Smyrna in its entirety. From time to time he fumbled a word, and a few times he even lost his place. I was certain now he must be hung over. But all in all, he gave a very powerful performance. Sappho seemed to think so. At several crucial points in the poem, including the suicide of King Cinyras, she burst into loud sobs. Fulvia and Polyxo each stood to one side of the girl, and together strove to comfort her. Perhaps uncharitably, I wondered if Antony's decision to read the poem was simply lazy, a way to avoid writing yet another eulogy on very short notice. Caesar's funeral must have already sapped his speech-making faculty. From time to time, as he recited, I looked at Fulvia, and from certain of her expressions I suspected it was she who suggested Antony would do better to read Cinna's poem than labour over a new speech. Whatever the inspiration or reasoning, the few of us in attendance were granted a rare opportunity to hear a gifted orator recite a much-celebrated poem. The ringing tones of Antony's polished voice lent a particular beauty and grace to certain passages that I hadn't perceived before. By the end, when Smyrna is transformed into a tree and her tears become myrrh, I too was in tears, and so was everyone else in the room. So powerful was this word image of the wretched Smyrna that for a moment I actually smelled the myrrh conjured up by Cinna's verses, an olfactory hallucination induced by poetry. Then I realized that the fire on the small altar had been lit, and someone had sprinkled myrrh on it at the precise moment of myrrh's appearance in the poem. Cinna had pulled the same trick when he read the final verses aloud to me. I smiled, remembering. But after an instant's pleasure, the scent induced another, quite opposite reaction. I shuddered and felt nauseated. Would I ever smell myrrh again, as I had smelled it just before Cinna's death, and not think of blood and beheading and dismemberment? Squaring her shoulders and forcing back tears, Sappho strode forward and picked up the bloody tunic, cradling it across her forearm. She stepped to the pyre and spread the tunic on the flames. For a moment, I thought the fabric might extinguish the fire and fill the room with smoke, but it caught fire and sent tongues of flames high in the air. Sappho stared at the flames. Antony stepped beside her,
In his hands he held the scroll from which he had been reading. When he laid the copy of the Smyrna on the pyre atop the tunic, I let out a gasp, shocked that the poem we had just heard was to be incinerated before our eyes. Of course, there were many copies of the Smyrna in the world, but even so, was it not a profane act to burn this copy? Then I grasped the symbolism. If sinner's corpse couldn't be purified by fire, then let his corpus be burned. As the scroll caught fire, belched flames, and shriveled to ashes, the magnitude of our loss was driven home to all present. Then the nursemaid stepped forward. In her wrinkled, bony hands, Polyxo held another scroll. Again, I gasped. Most scrolls look much alike. But this one I recognized by its unusually ornate dowels, carved from ivory with inlays of carnelian and caps of gold. I had seen such dowels only once before, at the dinner at the house of Lepidus, the night before Caesar died. I turned to Mito and whispered, "Is that what I think it is?" He frowned. "It looks like Sinner's copy of the Orpheus and Pentheus, yes?" He nodded. "The one Sinner lent to Caesar so that he could be the first to read it. Didn't Sinner tell Caesar it was the only copy?" "Yes." Mito furrowed his brow. "Caesar spoke of the grave responsibility thrust upon him, being entrusted with something so precious, so rare. And yet, with Antony and Sappho standing close by, Polyxo placed the scroll on the pyre, where it quickly caught fire. In a matter of seconds, while I watched, dumbstruck, the world's only copy of the Orpheus and Pentheus was reduced to ashes. Chapter 48 Incinerated before our eyes, the work that Caesar called the greatest poem in the Latin language?
That's not exactly what Caesar said, Papa.
Well, he said something close to that. After the funeral, Mito had come home with Bethesda and Diana and me. The women had retired to their rooms. My son and I sat in the garden.
What exactly did Antony tell you, Papa?
As we were leaving the funeral, I asked what document had been burned along with the Smyrna, and he said, "The other poem, the last one, Orpheus and Pentheus."
And you asked him if it was the only copy?
Of course I did. The circumstances had been quite awkward. After the items on the pyre were consumed and priests recited the usual prayers, the ashes were gathered and placed in a bronze urn, which was presented to Sappho. She held it as one might hold a serpent at arm's length. In that urn, symbolically, was all that remained of her father, the tunic stained with his blood, the Smyrna and the Orpheus and Pentheus, never to be read or recited to another mortal.
But why did Antony allow the Nubian nursemaid to burn it?
He said it was Sappho's wish. It was his judgment as executor of Sinner's will that Sappho had the right to do as she wished with her inheritance.
But Antony's also the girl's guardian now, said Mito. In the absence of a father or brother or husband, he's legally responsible for her. Sappho can't act on her own. Not in a matter of such importance. She has to obey his directives. Isn't that the law?
You're right, up to a point. Women have no standing and no rights under Roman law. All legal issues concerning a woman are to be decided by the man responsible for her. In this case, now that Sinner is dead, and by Sinner's will, Antony. But the burning of a poem breaks no law that I know of.
Anthony still could have stopped her, and he should have, said Mito. If not Anthony, then Fulvia. She seems to have a great deal of influence over the girl. I shook my head. I can hardly believe it myself. Caesar was the only man ever to read the poem from start to finish, and only a handful of us heard Cinna recite it. How long ago that night seems now. Sappho must know the poem. She must have heard her father reciting it, in bits and pieces, over all the years he worked on it. Yes, and even if she never heard or read the entire poem while Cinna lived, she had the opportunity to read that scroll in the hours after he died. Surely she did read it, said Mito. Unless to do so was too painful, evoking memories of her father. Whether she read it or not, it seems that she deliberately chose to burn it, not just to burn it, but to erase it from existence. The foolish girl! Hysterical, grieving, not thinking straight! Mito shook his head in disgust. I realized the poem had special significance for him, because Caesar had loved it, and the recitation by Cinna had been something Mito shared with Caesar. Now the poem was gone, like so many hopes and dreams that died with Caesar. Might it be possible to reconstruct it from memory? I wondered, if those of us who heard it combined the bits we could recollect. Impossible. Is your memory that exact, Papa? Mine isn't. Perhaps a few phrases linger in my memory intact. At best, we could come up with a mediocre patchwork, full of holes and errors, an insult to Cinna, not an homage. Caesar might have been able to recover it, or most of it, having read the poem and then heard it recited aloud. Caesar's memory was quite remarkable. But you and Lepidus and me? I don't count Decimus. I can hardly speak his name. Then the poem is gone. Truly gone, irretrievably and forever. Oh, Cinna, it should have been your monument. No day is more exhausting than a funeral day. Something about it saps all the energy from a man. I went to bed that night thinking I would sleep straight through till dawn. Instead, in the middle of the night, I awoke in a cold sweat, with a single word in my mind. Beware. In a dream, I had seen the word scratched in Greek in the sand before Cinna's door. Then a puff of wind blew it away. But the word reverberated in my waking mind. Beware. The word nagged at me, haunted me, and would not be silenced. Who had written it, and why? What did it mean? Cinna had made light of the incident, but he had been concerned enough to tell me about it. I had given little thought to the matter, even though he'd asked for my help. So much had intervened to distract me. Was it possible that the word scratched in the sand had been a very real warning, linked somehow to Cinna's death? That would mean that Cinna's murder was not an accident, not a horrific, meaningless stroke of bad fortune, but deliberate, targeted, premeditated. There had been a plot, then, just as there had been a plot to murder Caesar, and equally secret. But someone who knew of that plot, perhaps was part of it, had tried in a roundabout and feeble way to warn Cinna by scratching that word in the sand where he would be sure to see it. Feeble or not, the warning prompted Cinna to ask for my advice and for my help for all the good it did him. I had found his story mildly interesting, then forgot all about it in the hectic days that led up to Caesar's death. I had done nothing to save him. Now the word wouldn't leave me alone. Beware. If, in fact, Sinner's murder had been the result of a plot, then the circumstances of his death hadn't been accidental. Someone who wanted him dead had taken advantage of the violence and chaos surrounding Caesar's funeral, and the widely known fact that twice already a mob had wanted to kill the other Sinner, to make his death appear not planned, but spontaneous, not deliberate, but accidental, a twisted and tragic case of mistaken identity. But no, something was wrong with that idea. If Sinner, my Sinner, had been killed on purpose because of some personal or political grudge, then how could I account for the frenzy of the killers, who had not only beheaded him, but also torn him limb from limb, leaving nothing behind? That was not the way hired assassins would have gone about it. Hired killers would have dispatched him simply by slashing his throat or stabbing his heart, then run off as quickly as possible. They wouldn't have dismembered him and absconded with the remains. Nor did it seem likely that members of the mob, enraged at the sight of a man thought to be the other Sinner, would have gone about killing him in such a thoroughly gruesome fashion. Might it be that the way Sinner was killed, rather than indicating a spontaneous action, indicated the opposite, that the killing was completely premeditated? But why the beheading? Why the dismemberment? Lying awake at the middle of the night, I tried to remember exactly what happened, precisely what I had seen. But my memories had become even more hazy and confused. Perhaps that was due to the blows to my head, or perhaps the late hour. I could recall only fleeting impressions, bloody and horrific, hardly discernible from the sleeping nightmares into which I drifted by imperceptible degrees.
Day 14, March 23rd. Chapter 49. The next morning, instead of sleeping late, as would have been my prerogative on my 66th birthday, I was up at dawn, having been awakened by a visit from Sinner. In my dozy dream, as I was on the very brink of consciousness, Sinner had appeared before me, his head restored to his shoulders. When he opened his mouth, I heard him very clearly. "You heard, but heard not. You saw, but saw not. You know, but know not, because you wish not to know." "What sort of rubbish is that? A poem? A riddle?" I asked, perhaps out loud, for abruptly I was wide awake. I wasn't only awake, but trembling, seized by that unique sensation that comes only when one is exquisitely close to some monstrous truth. I tried to pin it down, but the impression slipped away from me. It was like trying to hold down a drop of quicksilver with a fingertip. It tantalized, that sensation of being so close but not quite knowing the truth about Sinner's death. Being on the very verge of knowing, apprehending some hint of the truth, but not the truth itself. Like smelling food before eating it. No, not the smell of food, but another smell. The smell of myrrh. When had I last smelled myrrh? The funeral, of course, and in a dream, and at the house of Sinner, when I called on Sappho. But before that, when had I last smelled it? It was at the scene of the murder. While all the other details had become muddled in my memory, that smell remained vivid, so vivid that in recalling it, I seemed to relive the very moment. Suddenly, I realized where the smell had come from. It wasn't from Caesar's funeral pyre, which was quite distant, but from somewhere much closer. And it wasn't the smoke itself I smelled, but the scent of myrrh second-hand, as if from garments permeated with the odour, from clothing. The smell had grown stronger, not fainter, as bystanders fled and the killers went about their butchery. Had it come from the clothing of the killers, then? Yes, because as they surrounded me and pressed closer together, the smell of myrrh became even stronger, almost overwhelming, and when they departed, the smell faded. Bothering to put on only a simple tunic, I had no time for a toga, I roused Davis and made him quickly dress, then herded him as a dog herds an ox through the house and out the front door. "Where are we going?" he murmured, wiping sleep from his eyes. "To the house of Cinna. Keep up!" I yelled, for I felt compelled to walk very fast. Even before I knocked on the front door, above my own panting breath, I heard the keening wail from within. I kept knocking until a slave opened the door, then pushed the slave aside and ran inside. In the room with the skylight where the funeral had taken place, Polyxo, racked with sobs, lay prostrate on the floor. I had come to confront Cinna's daughter, but that would never happen. From a rope with a noose tied to the ceiling hung the lifeless body of Sappho. Directly below her on the floor was the urn that held the ashes of her father's poems. Behind me, Davis gasped at the sight. "You saw, but saw not." What exactly had I seen when he was killed? I had seen a claw-like hand holding Cinna's head by the hair, quite literally a claw, as I later imagined, the claw of a fury. But it was no fury holding Cinna's head, nor any other divine or supernatural being. It was the hand of an ordinary mortal woman, gnarled and bony and wrinkled, to be sure, and as black as the talons of a fury. The hand of Polyxo, the same hand that yesterday I had seen place the scroll of Orpheus and Pentheus on the funeral pyre. The nursemaid looked up and saw me. Her face was twisted with grief, the ebony skin as gnarled and wrinkled as her hands. "I walk and found her like this," she wailed. "She must have done it. In the middle of the night, in that still hour, when the flame of the spirit burns low, oh, my Sappho!" I shivered. Had it happened at the very moment I woke in a cold sweat? Was that the instant of Sappho's death? "Was this her first attempt?" I asked. Unlike the thoughts raging in my head, the words I spoke were quite muted and calm.
"No. 3 times before this, she tried to do it. Always I stopped her. I feared, even now, even with him gone, she might try again. But last night, I was so weary. Oh, Sappho!"
"You couldn't watch her every hour of the day and night. You're not to blame. Not for this death, anyway. Was it your idea to kill Cinna?" Polyxo stiffened and swallowed her sobs.
"No, it wasn't I who thought of such a thing."
"Who then?"
"Sappho. It was she who first thought of doing it."
"But you approved?"
"I told her it would be proper and just. I said to her, 'Instead of killing yourself, dear child, kill the one who made you.'"
"And yet, it was Sappho who scratched that word in the sand, the Greek word for beware. It must have been her, You didn't write it. You know no Greek.
Yes, it was Sappho. In a moment of weakness, she wrote that warning. Perhaps she thought he would take heed and stop. But he didn't.
I felt a chill. You mean he was still...
Yes, right to the end.
I thought perhaps it was all in the past.
Oh, no. It never stopped.
I gazed at the girl's lifeless body, swaying slightly despite the stillness of the room. She wanted her father to die horribly, but still she warned him.
Because the poor child was split in two, don't you see? Body and soul, torn in two, never whole. The master did that to her. A girl raped by her father can never be of one mind again. She would always love him, always want his love in return, and at the same time fear him, hate him. Even sometimes I think she desired him as a wife desires a husband, as if they had truly become husband and wife. But she was his daughter, not his wife. Oh, how she hated him! But she despised herself even more. She wanted to die. She wanted him to die. But she wanted to save him.
The poor girl, I whispered. Polyxo gazed up at Sappho's body. She clutched the girl's dangling ankles and sobbed. It was your hand I saw, Polyxo, holding up his head.
Yes.
And before that, it was your voice I heard. Tear him for his bad verses, then.
Yes.
I thought those words were a slur against sinner's poetry. Careless, hateful words spoken by some know-nothing. But you meant exactly what you said. You meant that his verses were bad, truly bad.
Wicked, impious, evil. To write about such a thing, to dote on it, to lavish on it so much loving care, and then to do it, not once, but many, many times. Yes, it was I who said those words about his verses, and it was I who tore off the hand that wrote them.
Nausea clutched my throat. I swallowed hard. There was another voice, the one I heard first, that said, "Look, there he is," pointing Sinner out to the killers. That wasn't your voice. It was a hoarse, husky voice, like scratchy wool upon the ear. No, more pleasing than that, like raw silk. A disguised voice, pitched deliberately low, so as to pass for a man's voice. It certainly fooled me.
But you know now, don't you? You are clever.
Polyxo flashed a bitter smile.
She's clever too, that one. As clever as you. As clever as any man.
Maybe too clever. Does she know yet about Sappho's death?
No. No one knows outside this house.
Let me go to her, then. Let me be the one to tell her what's happened, what all your secrecy and plotting and bloodshed have finally accomplished. With Davis beside me, I descended the Aventine and headed for the Esquiline Hill, until at last we came to the House of the Beaks. In the forecourt outside the front door, a litter was departing. The occupant gave some signal to the bearers, for just as I was passing the litter, it came to a halt. It was quite plain, with nothing to distinguish it. Closed grey curtains, simple poles, no insignia. The curtains were parted by a delicate hand adorned with exquisite rings and bracelets, all of gold,
and set with fiery rubies that glinted by the light of the rising sun. "Good morning to you," Gordianus called Finder. I stopped and peered through the narrow opening in the curtains. I caught a glimpse of one eye peering back at me. "Is that you, Queen Cleopatra?" She gave a throaty laugh. "You sound surprised to see me. I would have thought the Queen of Egypt would be seen in a more conspicuous vehicle, one worthy of your divinity."
"Not in this town.
Not at this time. You're out and about very early in the day.
I had some business with your consul, Antony. Some final business, before I leave this place for good. It was an amicable parting."
"I'm rather surprised that you're still in Rome."
"It takes time to decamp a royal embassy, even in the wake of such a catastrophe."
There was a catch in her voice.
"I'll be gone within the hour. This closed litter will be loaded onto a barge on the Tiber. The barge will take me to Ostia. From there, a ship will take me back to Egypt. How curious that yours should be the last face I look upon in Rome."
I thought of the Queen's strange and twisting destiny. If Caesar had lived, and Cinna had successfully proposed the legislation allowing him foreign wives, Caesar's first act in Egypt might very well have been to marry Cleopatra and legitimize Caesarion as his heir, at least in Egypt, where Caesar would have become the legitimate king not by conquest, but by marriage. All that was impossible now, but Caesarion's legitimacy might yet be affirmed. This amicable meeting with Antony, may I take it that Rome has a royal prince now?
"Don't taunt me," Gordianus called Finder. "No, my son is not yet officially Caesar's heir, at least not here in Rome. But who knows what the future holds?"
A thought struck me. "The dictator gave you many gifts."
"Caesar and I often exchanged gifts, yes."
"Perhaps he gave you books for that famous library of yours."
"Certainly. He was very generous in that regard. He wished for the Library of Alexandria to possess all the best that the Latin language has produced."
"Including poetry?"
"Oh, yes."
"Are you familiar with the poet Cinna?"
"Of course. He was Caesar's friend."
"You know the Smyrna?"
"I do. A charming work. Caesar gave me a copy. I knew he loved it, so I read it with great interest. I suspect the library already has a copy or two. But I shall take the copy he gave me back to Alexandria as a memento."
She stopped speaking for a moment, choked by emotion.
"Of course, no Latin poem can ever match the best of Greek poetry, but Caesar thought it a masterpiece."
"What did you think of the subject matter? The incest, I mean. Cleopatra's family was notorious for marriages between royal siblings. She herself had been married to one younger brother, killed in the civil war between them, and was now married to an even younger brother, on whose longevity I wouldn't care to wager. But as far as I knew, the Ptolemies never sanctioned marriage between parent and child."
"The poem was merely true to the legend," she said.
I nodded. "I don't suppose..." My heart beat faster.
Was it possible? I don't suppose that Caesar gave you a copy of another poem by Cinna, a new poem about Orpheus and Pentheus. There was a pause that stretched until I found it almost intolerable. No, he finally said. He did mention such a work, something the poet was still working on, or perhaps had just finished. But no, I never saw a copy. Ah, well, safe travels, Queen of Egypt, to you and your son. And may your dealings be safe as well, Gordianus called Finder, if you choose to remain in this nest of vipers. The bejeweled hand withdrew. The curtains fell shut. The litter began to move again. That was the last that I, or anyone else, was ever to see of Cleopatra in the city of Rome. Chapter 50. Before I could knock, the front door of the House of the Beaks opened for me. I had been observed, talking to Cleopatra in the forecourt, and recognized. Antony, informed of my visit, had instructed a slave to admit me at once. I told Davis to wait for me in the vestibule. The slave led me down quiet hallways. I heard the hushed murmurs and soft footfalls of numerous slaves going about their early morning chores. Antony greeted me in a reception room off the garden. He was casually dressed in a green linen gown, a garment I would have thought more suitable for sleeping or lying about the house than for receiving the Queen of Egypt. A bit incongruous was the elaborate silver pectoral he was wearing, a massive thing with jewel inlays, depicting a hawk with outspread wings, clearly of Egyptian design. He saw me staring at it. "Do you like it?" he asked. "A parting gift from Queen Cleopatra. A bit gaudy, perhaps." "Quite beautiful," I would say. "Yes, well, I can't imagine where or on what occasion I could possibly wear such a thing here in Rome. Perhaps in one of the Asian provinces at some informal gathering, not requiring a toga or military dress." Stroking the gleaming silver with a forefinger, he seemed to ponder this idea rather fondly. Did he dream of taking up Caesar's ambition to invade Parthia? Ah, well, gaudy or not, it's certainly quite valuable. "A precious gift," I agreed. "The Queen must greatly esteem you." "What Cleopatra esteems is the future friendship of Rome," said Antony with a laugh. "Although, well, don't tell my wife I said so, but she's quite a charmer, isn't she?" Caesar thought so. "But you don't. Ah, Finder, always immune to bad influences. But no, I mustn't call you that any more. Senator Gordianus, I should say. If indeed I am a senator." "Ah, yes. I understand your concern, given how the day of your induction was interrupted." He took a deep breath. "Have no fear. You are as certainly a senator of Rome as I am consul. That's the deal we struck with the others. All Caesar's appointments must be respected, all of them. That includes your appointment to the Senate. I specifically made sure of that, as a favour to Mito." "And to ensure Mito's allegiance to you," I thought, "and my allegiance as well." "Thank you, Consul." "You are most welcome, Senator." "May I ask you a question, then, as Senator to Consul?" "Certainly." "The funeral oration. Was there more than one version?" Antony gave me the thinnest of smiles. "Astute of you, Senator, to perceive the situation. Yes, ahead of time we considered various scenarios for how the day might play out. Had the crowd been
unexpectedly hostile to Caesar, we had a very short and very bland eulogy prepared. If the crowd proved to be volatile, we planned for that eventuality as well. And that was how things turned out. Rather more volatile than I expected, in fact. So yes, we prepared more than one version of the speech. We? Did I say we? Several times. Terrible habit. One should never refer to oneself in the plural. I thought perhaps the we included the consul's wife as his collaborator. Antony narrowed his eyes. Nothing slips past you, does it? No wonder Cicero speaks ill of you behind your back, and that you tried even Caesar's patience. I'll only say this. No consul could ask for a better helpmate than my wife. Her contributions to the funeral day were incalculable. Yet I didn't see her among the grieving women with Calpurnia. I didn't see her at all. No? Well, I hardly saw her that day myself. We were both very busy.
I was most certainly present at the funeral of Caesar, said Fulvia, who seemed to have appeared from nowhere, as if my words had conjured her.
Antony seemed as startled as I was. He frowned for a moment, then gave her a crooked grin. "Well, Senator Gordianus," he said, "have I assured you of your status? Was that the business you had with me this morning?"
"No. Actually, it was the consul's wife I came to see."
"Oh, yes." He gave me a quizzical look. "Well, here she is. Are you receiving visitors, wife?"
"No."
Like Antony, Fulvia was dressed in a sleeping gown that immodestly left her arms uncovered. "But I'll make an exception for the finder."
"You must call him Senator now, my love."
He slowly nodded. She studied my face and frowned.
"Is this a delicate matter, Senator?"
I took a deep breath.
"Very much so."
"Husband, would you..." Antony took his wife's unspoken hint and stepped toward the door. Was he always so obliging to her wishes? "And Antony, do take off that hideous thing. The fewer people who see it, the better." Antony lifted the silver pectoral over his head with a sigh as he stepped out of the room, leaving us alone. Fulvia looked at me steadily, not saying a word, forcing me to speak first. "When Caesar died," I said quietly, "when I saw him killed before my eyes, it was a horrible thing, a terrible shock, almost unthinkable. And yet, who among us was truly surprised? Only a few days have passed, yet now it seems almost as if his death was preordained, inevitable, certainly understandable. And then I saw Cinna die."
"Did you actually see it happen?" he said sharply.
"Not exactly. I was struck on the head twice, as I told you the other day." She nodded. "However jumbled my senses, what I witnessed that day was even more horrible than what I saw when Caesar died. Cinna was quite literally ripped apart, his head and his limbs torn from his body, killed as Orpheus was killed and Pentheus. But why? People say he was mistaken for the other Cinna, ripped to pieces by mistake, killed for no reason, his body defiled, his head displayed on a pole. It was incomprehensible. Caesar's death, at least, made sense. But to be so gruesomely murdered by mistake, except, of course, that it wasn't a mistake. Cinna was deliberately killed. There was a reason. Fulvia stared at me, her eyes fixed on mine. At last she spoke.
Father Liber commanded it.
No, Fulvia, you commanded it.
As a priestess of Father Liber, yes.
For a long moment I was speechless. I hadn't really expected her to admit her guilt. Now that she had, I hesitated to pursue the questions in my head, dreading the answers. Whom did you command, and why, and what did you do with Cinna's body? Fulvia crossed her arms and raised her chin, looking as formidable as any man, so imposing that I took a step backward.
Which question should I answer first? She said quietly. I really shouldn't tell you who was involved. Now that you're a senator, you might actually be able to make trouble for us. But I think you won't, once you know the truth. Very well, then. Do you remember the women who attended the funeral yesterday?
I saw them. I didn't recognize them.
Good. Because those women were the vessels for the divine wrath that destroyed Cinna.
Women? You're telling me it was women who tore Cinna limb from limb? That's not possible.
No? You think that mere weak women could never be strong enough?
Clearly, Gordianus, you do not comprehend the Bacchic frenzy. Inspired by Dionysus, Father Liber, Bacchus, the god of countless names, and with just a touch of witchcraft, even mere women can exceed your wildest imagining. Witchcraft? I drew a sharp breath.
There is a point at which a mortal woman can become a Maenad, not merely like a Maenad, a moment of metamorphosis. Certain spells must be cast. Elixir. A very skillful witch.
The Nubian nursemaid? You telling me Polyxo can transform mortal women into Maenads?
With the gods' help. Maenads, Bacchanti, vessels of the righteous anger of Dionysus, daughters of Father Liber.
I had thought, I dreamed, of the Furies.
It had nothing to do with the Furies. Her eyes flashed. Only Dionysus.
But you were there to lead them? It was your voice I heard, wasn't it? Cinna heard it too, a voice that called out his name, pointing him out to the others, a gruff, husky voice like raw silk upon the ear.
Like this, you mean? Cinna! Look, there he is! There is Cinna!
She reproduced the voice exactly as I had heard it that day. Hackles rose on the back of my neck. The voice seemed to come from somewhere outside her body. The effect was uncanny. I was taken back to that moment. I heard the roar of the crowd, saw Cinna smiling beside me, smelled the first hint of myrrh. Cinna thought he had been recognized by some lover of his poetry. Excited by the sight of him. Lover of his poetry, hardly that. Her laughter was harsh and cruel. Sappho, was she among the women?
No. From the beginning, it was decided that she should not be present or take part. There was to be no blood on her hands.
But she knew beforehand.
Yes, of course. It was done for her sake.
And yet she tried to warn her father?
Yes, in a moment of doubt, of weakness.
Sappho wrote that word in the sand. Poor sad thing. Was the word a warning or a threat? Did she intend to save her father or cause him dread? Whatever she was thinking, when I heard about it from Polyxo, I told her to stop. I wasn't about to see Cinna wriggle out of his punishment, now that the moment had finally come. I shook my head. The word beware in Greek had been used to warn Cinna. The same word had been used by Artemidorus in the note I had passed into Caesar's hand. Neither warning had been heeded, and they had nothing to do with each other. The moment had come, you say. Why that moment? Why that day for Cinna's death? We bided our time, thinking to do it after Caesar left for Parthia. With Antony running the city, I'd have a free hand. But then I learned that Caesar intended that Cinna would go with him. So it had to be done quickly, before they departed. Just as Caesar's killers had to act by the Ides of March, I said. Yes. First, I chose the Liberalia, knowing that the power of Father Liber and the witchcraft of Polyxo would be particularly potent that day. Polyxo, I said, struck by the bitter irony of her name. The Polyxo of legend had helped his daughter to save the king of Lemnos, when the women killed every man on the island. This Polyxo had done the opposite, and to think it was Cinna himself who gave her the name. The Liberalia, you say? But you didn't act then. No. After Caesar was murdered and the other Cinna made himself a target for the anger of the mob, not once but twice the fool. It struck me that the funeral day would provide the most opportune moment. Emotions running wild, passions unchecked, amid the frenzy of the crowd, the frenzy of the Maenads, could go unnoticed, especially if we cloaked ourselves and went about our business in silence. And the confusion of one Cinna with the other would divert any suspicion about the poet's death. Exactly. A horrible accident, people would say. The brainless mob mistook one Cinna for the other. You think like a man, I said. It wasn't a compliment. To control men, one must be able to think like one. And this was all done because Sappho told you that Cinna, she claimed that he claimed. Is that why you're here, Finder? Because you think your drinking companion was falsely accused? You imagine his poor half-mad daughter concocted such a story? What proof did you have that Cinna did such a thing? If it was only Sappho's word, Cinna's own words convicted him. You mean the Smyrna? It's only a poem, Fulvia. A fantasy based on ancient legend. Cinna didn't invent the story. Yes, it obviously fascinated him. I don't mean that odious poem. As I said, his guilt was proved by his own words. You confronted him? I had no need to. She crossed the room and took a small box from a shelf. From a silver chain around her neck she produced the key required to unlock it. From the box she pulled a small rolled parchment. What is that? I asked. A bit of writing by Cinna that we did not burn on his funeral pyre. See for yourself. She thrust it into my hand. Chapter 51. I unrolled the parchment. It was a letter addressed to my darling Sappho from your loving father. There were other words, but my eyes seemed of their own volition to land on the most pertinent. The handwriting was unmistakably Cinna's. Obviously, you've enjoyed it from the very first time. Any child would. I think you invited it. Yet you waste your time and your art, doting on some imaginary wound I inflicted on you. Show me no more hand-wringing poems on this topic, I implore you. Leave behind this invented guilt and face the truth.
that the act gives pleasure to us both, that it means